Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. Give me a kind of a game plan on the program, the agenda. We have public hearings on Senate Bill 689 as well as 692. We will not be working 689 to its conclusion because there's some more amendments. 692, I think we have everything ready to go if we want or we don't. Okay, so we're not going to be moving either. Those will be just for public hearing. And I believe the two on the work session, 493 and 751, are ready. Except to take that back. 493, we're still waiting for the fiscal. All right, so with that, let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 689. What I'm going to do is ask Whitney to give us an overview. Senator Dimbros and Representative Parrish are going to kind of lead off.
And Frederick as well.
Oh, I did not see him on the list. We will put him on the list. And so we will have the three members go forward. But Whitney, why don't you kick us off?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 689 reestablishes the Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. The task force would sunset on December 31st, 2018. There is a Dash 1 amendment that makes a minor technical change by requiring the Legislative Policy and Research Director to provide staff support for the task force. There is no revenue impact, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. And Senator Dimbro, did you want to go first?
Sure. Yes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, it's a real pleasure to bring these two bills before you. They're the product of the Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. Just to take us back a couple of years, in 2015, we passed the Ban the Box legislation and had a really vigorous conversation around the reason for that, because it was, you know, creating obstacles to employment for people who were formerly incarcerated. And as we were putting the final touches to that bill over here on the Senate side, it sort of fell into the laps of myself and Senator Winters to make the final changes to get that bill over the finish line. It was really clear to both of us that there were many more obstacles out there that people who are formerly incarcerated faced. And Senator Winters particularly wanted to see us create a task force to work on these, especially with respect to housing. And then in her inimitable style, she got me to chair it. It took us a while, but we finally got through the governor appointment process and started meeting. Representative Parrish and then Representative Frederick were the House members who were on the task force. And we met for a number of months, looked at things sort of in a kind of chronological order, with the assumption that the more that inmates could be prepared for release while they were on the inside in terms of training, education programs, things like that, the more successful their release. And so we kind of followed through the stages of the process. Did a lot of work on housing, but learned that we're in the middle of a kind of changing terrain as far as housing goes. We were, I think, initially thinking about doing something like Ban the Box for housing. We heard from some of the specialists on housing that because of recent Supreme Court decision with respect to what's called disparate impact, that the practice of discriminating against people with criminal records might be unconstitutional. And that's something that's being sorted out right now. Anyway, we spent a lot of time on that, on housing issues, on employment issues, issues related to court fees and fines and the burdens that placed, driver's license suspensions, just a number of things. And we At the end of the day, we're able to recommend, I think, six pieces of legislation that are in process this session. One of the things that we realized at the end was that one of those pieces would need to be removing the sunset on the task force, because there's a lot more work to be done, a lot more work with respect to court fees and fines, a lot more work with respect to challenges faced particularly by women inmates, a number of issues. And so that's why you have before you Senate Bill 689, which reestablishes the task force. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues to give their perspective on this. We may be looking at an amendment to this with respect to adding a couple of members. There was actually nobody on the task force formally from Department of Corrections, and it seemed like there really needs to be. We kind of lucked out in that we had a couple of members on the task force who were themselves formerly incarcerated, but it wasn't really designated for that. And we had a number of people who came to the meetings and added their perspective, and that was great. So some of us are talking about actually designating that that we have a couple of members of the task force be formally incarcerated, perhaps one male and another female, just so we get both perspectives, and perhaps have someone who represents law enforcement on it as well, to give that perspective. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues, and we'll come back when we get to Senate Bill 692.
All right, thank you. I'll let you choose, but I would say Representative Parrish was here first, so.
Thank you, Chair Vyzanski, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. Now I feel like we're like a lopsided committee, because I'm like the only one left from the House on this committee. Everybody else is senators. So maybe I should run for the Senate. Except when you run for office, you don't really put like, I'm going to go fix the prison system on your campaign mailers. It's just one of those things that falls into your lap. I think you have to find a personal spot in your heart to want to care about this population. I just happen to be related to like half the population. I always jokingly say, you know, I come here to make the laws while my siblings are out breaking them. In all seriousness, I've personally experienced through family watching the reentry system. If you've been here for a while, you know that my sister came out of Coffee Creek and pretty shortly thereafter died of a heroin overdose. And And if that doesn't inform your thought process on justice and reentry, and I actually did not vote for the ban the box because I didn't think it was the right solution, but some of the solutions that we came up with in this task force around licensure, Oregon overly licenses people in fields where they probably don't need to have a preclusion on their license requirement for being a felon. And so it's tough to get people into family wage jobs because we as a state restrict them. When my sister died, she actually died with a lot of fines to the DMV, and Multnomah County, I think, tried to collect for like the next couple years. And I can't tell you how many times my husband sent a death certificate to say you're not getting any money out of this. Like, it's a done deal. I recently had a nephew come out of the justice system in the Oregon Youth Authority. I've got a brother who somewhere along the lines, I think, is somewhere between Idaho and Washington prison system. So when I look at these issues, it to me is a very personal, it's a very personal matter. I think we just barely scratched the surface on reentry issues and the types of policies that we need to have to slow that revolving door around our prison system. I somewhere halfway fell asleep the other night in the middle of the news as there was a news story about a woman from Oregon City getting a life sentence. That means she's going to Coffee Creek. And we know we have problems in our women's system of not having enough beds and having overcrowding. And do we open up another facility, or do we find ways to keep people from going into these facilities? I have to say, I think we've done a lot since I've been in the legislature around things like health care for people coming out of the justice system to make sure that all the time and money we spend on stabilizing people with mental health and addiction treatment doesn't go to waste when we send them out the door with only a 30-day prescription of their medication, that we've made sure that they can access the Oregon Health Plan and that we are providing continuity of health care services for folks. And so Again, this isn't necessarily one of those issues that I ran for office, but to me, I think when we're talking about the average cost of housing a prisoner, you know, somewhere in the $40,000 range, higher in the healthcare, high needs healthcare population in our prison system, that we still just have a lot of work to do to make sure that even if people go in, and I'm all about people going in when they need to go in, but when they come out, that there is some level of forgiveness in the law, some level of being able to reconnect people back into their communities. I have bills up in housing this morning. One of them is around giving churches and nonprofits the ability to site accessory dwelling units. It's in the housing committee right after this bill. And ideally looking at to our faith-based community and our nonprofit community as a way to have transitional housing for people who come out of the justice system, that if there are churches out there that want to include that as part of their mission, that we give them a land use exemption to be able to site those types of homes in their communities and connect people to housing. We know that part of this housing crisis is, you know, if you take it down in pieces with demographics, are people coming out of our justice system who are struggling to find a place to live. And I'll tell you from personal experience, if you can't solve that issue around having somebody come out of prison and have a place to live, you just aren't going to be able to keep them stabilized. When my sister died, it was in a women's homeless shelter in Portland. And so it's a problem, and we know we need to fix it. I think the extension of the task force, I'm not sure what the fiscal is, but I think whatever that fiscal is, we will make it up on the back end when we continue to introduce policies that I think slow that revolving door. So I'm really supportive of the concept of the task force continuing. Happy to continue to serve on that task force if the speaker so chooses to assign me to it. I hate task force as a general rule, but this is just such a complicated issue that I think we have to untangle it and unwind it so that we can have policies that come forward in the next biennium that continue to try to move this work forward. So I just really appreciate your time this morning.
Lou. Thank you. I'm Senator Lou Frederick from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you, Chair and Committee. It does show the difference. I actually did run part of my campaign on the fact that we're dealing with the prison system, because I have enough people in my community who wanted to know when we were going to actually do something that was going to be effective. The issue in my community is often, okay, so somebody goes into to prison and then they come out and you are continuing to punish them for the rest of their lives, and that does not help with families who are trying to reconnect, to try to actually be effective with as parents. You can't do that if you're continuing to punish folks. And that's one of the issues that I think that I had to deal with in my campaign. So it's really interesting that I understand the personal aspect for Representative Parrish, but for me it's also truly a political one. The complications, as Representative Parrish mentioned, are really extraordinary, and the connections between housing, education, jobs, alcohol and drug abuse treatment, all of those things are all part of this, as well as some simple things like driver's licenses, like understanding how you connect with other government agencies when you come out as well, and obviously the fees and the fines that I mentioned a couple of days ago here. But for me, it is really a matter of finding a way that we can begin to model how we want to really help people once they have paid their debt to society, and make sure that they get a chance to come out and be effective. We had some really extraordinary folks on the task force and attending the task force. The task force meetings were held in this room, and we were full for the most part with people who wanted to talk about it. And I thought that was outstanding. So I think we should continue it. I think it saves us not only money, but frankly, it saves us Oregonians. We're going to be able to actually be effective and help people. So that's how I've approached it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for the panel or for Senator Denbrough? Senator Thatcher.
Just one comment, and I appreciate your statement that I hate task forces in general, but it is such a complicated issue that it needs to be in well. I appreciate that, because I was wondering, okay, so why couldn't we have a work group like, well, you're famous for doing and putting together, and maybe that would work. But I think you're onto something here, and I appreciate your statements.
Mr. Chair, can I just add one thing? And that is, you know, one of the things that the task force did was produce a final report, which I'm just realizing, I haven't sent it to be posted, but we should post it, and you all should get it. It's full of, you know, just really interesting research and observations. And, you know, one of the things that we learned was that, you know, obviously the real danger of poor reentry is recidivism and, you know, the sort of revolving door. But if you have a successful reentry and someone is out for 5 years or more, doesn't reoffend, then their chances of committing an offense are no greater than anyone in the population. That's what the you know, the research that we were introduced to shows. And so, you know, that I think is really it is really telling information. I will say also, with respect to the task force, we are in conversation with there exists a standing group that the governor has, the Governor's Reentry Council, which includes top people from different agencies and those who are working in the area of reentry. And there's some interest in actually housing this task force in the Governor's Reentry Council, that would create the sort of infrastructure and the administrative support for it, that this would actually become a subcommittee of the Reentry Council. It's something we're kind of thinking through. I'll want to talk to my colleagues about that idea. Is it better to have it as a standalone legislative thing, or does it make more sense to have it working in concert with the Reentry Council? So that's, we may have some amendments around that.
All right, Senator Manning.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. Representative, thank you so much for sharing your story. That was, I completely understand, you know, and in spite of all the pain, you know, here you are. So thank you so much.
All right, Mr. Chair, I want to make a couple comments. First, that I think that this is appropriate for a task force. And the reason, my definition or distinction is that this is something that's going to be ongoing, more than just something for a session for a bill. And I expect that it should, in fact, continue. And I really would caution us folding this into the executive branch. I really think it's very important to have this as a legislative branch issue. It doesn't mean that we're not going to work with them. We should be working with them hand in hand. But I think there's a check and balance here. To me, it's very important that we have our hands on it and it's our product, because if there's sometimes maybe a disagreement, could be based on finances, who knows what. I just think that having a separate eye, so that's my encouragement for this task force to stay as a legislative. And regarding the cost, basically this is just having the old community services, whatever it's now called, actually be the go-to for staffing. And I think that's something that hopefully is built into the budget already, so we can in fact utilize individuals that are part of our permanent staff in these capacities. Any other comments for this group, Representative Parrish?
Thank you. You know, Senator Denbrough hit on something that I think it was probably, for me, a very interesting piece of this, in that, you know, if we can stabilize folks coming out of the justice system, that eventually they don't go back in, they just be fold back into society. And there's a parallel in my life. I've seen people come out of the justice system. I've seen people come home from war, right? My husband's a veteran. And it's interesting because the DOD has really figured this out. They understand that when you send people off to war, when you institutionalize that, you know, in a more positive way, I guess, in the military, you know, people are wanting to go to that institution. But they recognize that that sort of decompressing people out, you know, when you send somebody home, you don't send them right back out onto the street when they come back. They stop at a military post as they're coming back in from Iraq or Afghanistan, and they spend 30 days there sort of deprocessing, and then we, you know, gradually bring them back into their families. The DOD has recognized that in that first 90 days, it's kind of like a honeymoon, and then you start to have the issues around mental health and the challenges around joblessness and all of those things. And so they continue to sort of offer services even years after, if you're still in the military, that calibrate those veterans, right, and that help them maintain. We just send people right out of the prison system and be like, there you go, have at it, and good luck to you. And we don't have a lot of those wraparound supports. And our supports are in the first 90 days when you're still kind of in that honeymoon phase of coming out of the justice system. And so there is a lot more work to try to figure out what is that longer-term piece. And I don't think we have all the answers yet, but this definitely gives us a chance to sort of look at that, those two parallel processes, and go, one group's kind of doing a better job of this on the military side. The other piece is we know that a lot of folks in our justice system rapidly are veterans. That is a very quickly increasing population. There is another bill that is kind of moving through the system on the House veterans about connecting people to their DOD earned benefits that they can get even while they're in the justice system. So there's just lots of moving parts about stabilizing folks. And again, I just really appreciate, Chair, that you're interested in seeing this continue.
All right. Thank you very much. So I'm going to go ahead and call up our next panel, Truls Neal, Brian Judd, and Jim Netherwood.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning to all. Who would ever like to start off, if you'll give us your name first and then your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Prozanski and board panel members, committee members. My name is Truls Neal, Deputy Director, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm also was a member of the task force for 2016. And I also represent the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. Just a few weeks ago, here in Salem, we hosted the What Works Conference. A New York judge, Block, spoke about the collateral consequences of felony convictions. He had come up with about 40,000 collateral consequences for being a felon or having been imprisoned. Here in Oregon, some of those that affect our population are access to housing, access to employment. For instance, in Oregon, if you have a felony record, you cannot get a license to be a beautician. Not sure what the connection is there. The Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing has been helpful to community corrections in identifying barriers and proposed solutions to assisting justice-involved adults in improving barriers to reentry around employment and housing. Several legislative bills have been a result of the task force work. Additionally, the task force work in helping community corrections, Department of Corrections, and stakeholders examine issues related to reentry and make changes. Senator Prozanski pointed out something that I agree with in terms of having this as a task force. I think helps us ask tough questions, because a lot of us in the system have different authorities we answer to and different priorities. So I think it was a good move to have the task force separate. One concept that the task force is working on that's going to be talked about later is the pre-entry. I think this is very valuable to the justice-involved adults we work with. Often they will go to prison or jail, and they will lose things like birth certificates, Social Security cards. They won't have an opportunity to get their financial matters in order. And when they come out, those things just hit them like a wave, and then they can't recover from them. And they spiral back into whatever things that we don't want them to spiral back into. So the Oregon Community Corrections Directors support the work of and the extension of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Housing, and Employment. And we hope that this work will continue. It's important work to us as well.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Hello. Good morning, Senator Prozanski and members of the committee. My name is Jen Netherwood. I am a journey-level carpenter with the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute. I'm also an instructor and an outreach specialist. I became involved in reentry work after working at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for about 15 months. I ran a construction trades pre-apprenticeship program inside the medium wing of the facility. And it's important to mention that prior to actually working at Coffee Creek, I had never been involved in the justice system. I was never had stepped inside a prison or a jail. I just luckily fell into this position. It had a major impact on me, and after the program was cut in 2013, I have remained an advocate for construction trades training inside of facilities, and subsequently became an advocate for reentry and helping this population make a smooth transition back. One of the main things I learned as a member of the task force was just how complex this issue of reentry is. I found that we had a broad range of stakeholders, a broad range of task members, and I think that's critical so that we don't miss anything. We need to have a lot of different perspectives looking at this issue from all different angles so that nothing gets fallen through the cracks. I believe that the union construction industry can play an important role for men and women reentering society after incarceration because it offers those that are willing to work hard a family wage career in an environment where their legal history does not create significant barriers for them. A large part of my role on the task force was to look at an existing House bill, House Bill 2986. This was sponsored by Senator Dembrow and passed in 2013. House Bill 2986 allowed folks with suspended license to petition the courts to get a provisional license upon entry into a pre-apprenticeship program or an apprenticeship program. To date, there is only one person that I know of. She's a female apprentice at IBEW Local 48 who has actually been able to navigate and use the bill. So a big part of my participation on the task force was to look at this and try to find out why this isn't being more widely used. There are a lot of qualified people I found that were applying to apprenticeship programs that weren't able to get in because they didn't have a driver's license. And I discovered two main barriers to them being able to use this bill. One is that to be accepted into many of these apprenticeship programs, you have to already have the driver's license. So there was kind of a catch-22. They were applying to get in, and they were a qualified candidate, but they couldn't score high enough on the application because they didn't have the driver's license, and they couldn't get the driver's license because they weren't in the apprenticeship. So we worked with Steve Sims, who is the Director of Apprenticeship and Training through BOLI. And because of his work, we created a pathway so that people could use the legislation as it exists without having to rewrite or change the language of the bill. And this pathway will take major communication between the applicant, the courts, BOLI, DMV, and the apprenticeship program. But we believe that the pathway we've created eliminates the catch-22, as long as everyone plays nice. So we made significant progress towards allowing House Bill 2986 to do the work that it was designed to do, but there is still the education aspect. One of the major reasons that people aren't using this bill is because people don't know about this bill. The apprenticeships that I spoke to didn't know about it, and they play a significant role in being able to guide their applicants in terms of how to best present themselves as a qualified applicant. So we still need to do a lot of work with existing pre-apprenticeships and apprenticeship programs to develop kind of a toolkit that we can get out to the public so that this bill is more widely known about and people will know how to navigate it. It's also important to look at how we're currently preparing incarcerated people for construction trades career and connect them with those jobs before they parole. The biggest value of the Senate Task Force on Reentry, Housing, and Employment that I saw was most apparent when we would have speakers come in and give us different research. Having all of the different members of the task force be able to ask tough questions from all their different perspectives, I thought was extremely valuable. And we grilled some people. We asked some really tough questions to some of the different folks, and I think we got some very good answers, which has translated into the six pieces of legislation that Senator Dembrow mentioned. Senator Dembrow also mentioned that there was significant interest from the community. We had a lot of members of the community, and they were consistently asked for their input and testimony during our meetings, and they brought a lot of value to the task force. So this collective legislative voice led to the creation of some of these bills. But as I mentioned with House Bill 2986, even if all of six pieces of these legislation pass, there's going to be things that still need to be worked out with those bills. There's many things that we weren't even able to work on because the issue is so complex. And I think as long as there's incarcerated people in the state of Oregon that are going to be rejoining our communities, this task force must continue to try to try to work out a lot of these issues. And the last thing I wanted to say is an update. When I worked at Coffee Creek, we put 40 women through the program. And I am just now seeing one of the fruits of all the hard work that I put in. I have a woman who has paroled from Coffee Creek recently, who went through our Carpenter Trades Preparation Program, and she applied, she's gotten in, and she will be starting work with Western Partitions in the next couple of weeks. Her son also will be starting as a first-term apprentice as well, so I'm really happy about having at least one success story coming out of that. So thank you, committee members.
Thank you. And that brings Brian.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Brian Jed. I am currently the program manager for Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center. Previous to that, I worked with Bridges to Change, also a member of the Joint Task Force on Reentry, Housing, and Employment. Previous to that, I was a participant in reentry. And having come out of the Department of Corrections through the reentry coordination team in Multnomah County, I had wraparound supportive services. I was able to get a good ground eye view of what works, what worked for me, what worked for others, and what didn't work for unfortunately many others. The crises we see out there around housing and the barriers that come with the felony record to obtaining housing. Let's see, I'm 7 months away from my expungement. I was incarcerated for nonviolent property offenses related to my addiction. I've been in recovery since my arrest. And I still live in a felony-friendly landlord, even though I'm pre-approved to hopefully buy a house. My work has been with nonprofits where a requirement of my employment was previous incarceration to deliver effective peer-based support. The work left to be done around the opioid addiction epidemic. You know, yes, treatment works when we have internally motivated individuals ready to take advantage of it. People lacking that treatment teaches them how to succeed in treatment. And the resulting nature of that, with the end goal of people refraining from use, true abstinence is a free program out there with free classes and free people willing to teach what was freely given to them through self-help programs. With the budgetary issues of programs at risk that bring education and employment preparedness and life skills preparation, RentWell, for example, credit counseling, financial skills into the preparing people for release. I was able to take advantage of many of those programs, and they've greatly helped my reentry. On the task force, the diversity we have there, expanding that is a great idea. I think it was well represented and gave us the ability to reach out to other successful states even and have a forum for them to reach out and see our work so we can help just not our citizens but citizens of other states. You know, continuing finding effective evidence-based practices to change thinking, which is a critical step before we expect to change behavior. Having practices and policies and programs in place that give people the opportunity to have value, to have self-esteem and self-worth, getting down to the core issues of why people act in such a selfish manner, especially in addiction, especially in criminality. A lot of it is they feel like they're in a position to decide what's best for them at whatever cost to other people. Programs that intercede in that and require action upon the participants, those are what I feel are our best bet as to what works. What gets people to turn around is really giving them opportunity to engage in something that changes their thinking. If we want to change their behavior, that's our direction we have to go, and the task force work around those issues and looking at programs to expand education and training into the Department of Correction post and post-release, including the life skills, employment, and housing. Those reduce recidivism. Those increase public safety. And this task force being able to guide some of the innovation and influence and have the impact is something that I was thankful to hear the testimony previously stating that this should be something that's ongoing. There's a lot of work to be done. Thank you, everyone, for your time this morning.
Thank you all very much. Let's see if there's any questions. Thank you very much for coming forward. I have one other panel at this point, and that's Nora Sweet and Kendra Wright. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony?
Nova.
Nova? Well, it looks like an R to me. I'm sorry. All right. I will see your V's or my R's. Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
And ladies, who would I like to go first?
Go ahead. Okay. Hi. I'm Nova Sweet, members of the committee, and Chair Prozensky. Is that how you pronounce your name? Nice to meet you. So my name's Nova. Like I said, I was incarcerated at Coffee Creek Corrections for 36 months. I have been out for approximately 2 years. I learned about the reentry task force, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so, and was honored to be able to just come in and sit in and give my two cents because there was so many good things being talked about. I'm in full support of this committee continuing. They do really good work. They had many issues that they were discussing, and they got very deep on a lot of those issues. I do strongly urge that you guys expand it and add some people who have actually been in the system, because there's lots of great talk about policy and procedure and what works and what doesn't work, but how do you guys really know unless you have somebody who's actually been through it? So I think that was a piece that was missing, and one of the reasons I was constantly raising my hand about, you haven't thought about this. So to really do this work and actually create some change, I think you need some people that have been through the system that want to help. So one of the issues that happened with me as far as reentry goes has to do with employment. And I'm excited that the committee, or the task force, excuse me, was continuing to discuss licensure issues. When I too am an addict. I've been clean for 5 years, but my downfall took me away from a profession of child and family therapy. I'm a MSW from Portland State and have over 15 years of child and family therapy experience. And so obviously I'm a risk to that population now because of my experience. There's too many reasons to make sure that I don't work with those populations, even though I've not harmed any children or done any violent crimes. It's just a no-brainer in my mind. However, I am a social worker, and I do feel like I can help people, especially people like myself who are coming out of the system. And so I applied for a peer recovery mentor job with Benton County Mental Health, and the county loved me, and they hired me. And so I quit my other job, which was managing a gymnastic studio, which I knew nothing about, but was able to find somebody was going to give me a break. I had never worked for an hourly wage before. I'd always been a salary person, and I have two kids, and trying to figure out how to make $15 an hour work for that was really interesting. So I was really excited about this peer recovery mentor job. County hired me. They knew about my background. They needed to get a sign off from the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon 4 weeks later said, no, she can't work for you guys. So I was devastated, obviously. So what happened was, since I quit my other job, I had to go and get TANF. I had to go get on welfare. So I stressed out another system in our state. So for 4 months, I think I was on welfare and food stamps, all those good things, programs for people that don't even have a high school diploma I got to participate in, because that's the requirement when you have to do those programs, which, great, fine. Meanwhile, I'm advocating with the state about why it would be okay to be a peer recovery mentor, and I'm providing all this information and documentation. And I'll tell you what, 2 weeks ago, I finally got approved. The state was like, yeah, we think you'd be okay. And so I have the lady's name written down, and she's going to be my lifelong friend, because she told me, she's like, I actually think you'd be really good at this. And I'm like, thank you for finally, somebody listened to me. Now, that job's no longer available because I was hired 4 months ago, but that's okay. All right. At least I got that. I made that that hallmark, you know, and I'm like, okay, the state is like okay with me trying to do this. And so there is a job now in Linn County, which I'm going to apply for. And hopefully next time I talk to you guys, I'll have that job. But that's just one of the things that happened for me. And I just think that those kinds of things that this reentry task force could talk about, and we can just keep working on solving the problems that we have in Oregon. And on the backside, we won't be going back to prison because we feel like we're involved and we're connecting. So thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Kendra?
Hi. Good morning, members, Chair. My name is Kendra Wright. I am an advocate with the YWCA and formerly incarcerated. I served 39 months out of a 60-month sentence. Upon release, there were many, many challenges. My finances were one of them. Just to get my license, I had to go through many steps with the courts, asking them to pull back my fines and fees from collections so I could start making payments. In order to drive, I spend on average about $200 a month just to be sure to have my license. I need to drive to go to school. I need to drive to go to work. I work full time so I can pay my fines and fees every month. And I also go to school full time. It's very stressful and challenging. So far, so good. This reentry task force is very vital. We have a system that has its flaws and is broken for many reasons. And being somebody who is now a member of society again, the problems continue. They don't just go away. I've been out of prison for 18 months now and met and exceeded many of the requirements. But there's still many things that need to be addressed. So I don't think that the task force expiring would be a good idea at all. There are hundreds and thousands of people that are affected by people being incarcerated and being released. And the biggest issue is when you're in prison, you're away from society, you're ostracized by your own doing, and then you come out and you're expected to just walk right into it. Without the support and encouragement, there's no hope. Being able to be a part of this task force, kind of by weaseling my way in there, like and over here, has allowed me to feel like I've been heard, like I have a voice and that I matter, which is vital, I think, to my success as well as others. I also agree with Nova and think that there should be members of the committee that have been prior incarcerated or had some sort of background, because the struggle is real, and to know the struggle is vital, to know what it's like to go through the hoops and to feel like some days you're just barely staying afloat while others you feel like you're being bogged down by all the obstacles. It's nice to feel supported and feel like what I have to say matters. So I think that's all I have to say on the issue. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming forward. That's very important to us to hear from those who really experience, and first of all, for you to be willing to tell your stories here. And two, I think it is just as important and shows how far you have come is your diligence in being part of the work group or the task force and wanting to be part of it and actually share your experiences there to help it make better not only for yourself but for others. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, that takes care of the individuals for public hearing on Senate Bill 689. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on that bill. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is on 692. Whitney.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 692 was also brought to us by Senator Dembro. Senate Bill 692 appropriates money from the general fund to the Public Defense Services Commission for creation of a pre-entry pilot program. There is a -2 amendment that directs the Public Defense Services Commission to provide these funds to the Metropolitan Public Defender Services for the pre-entry pilot program to be run in Multnomah and one rural county. It also requires the PD's office to collect data on this program and provide it to PDSC, and then has a requirement that PDSC review this data and prepare a report by February 1st, 2019. And there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Devereaux.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So this concept was one that surfaced during the work of the task force. Actually, it, I first became aware of it when I was visiting the Metropolitan Public Defenders in Multnomah County and met Alex Bassos, the deputy there, and, you know, who convinced me that we weren't thinking broadly enough. You know, as I mentioned before, we started the work of the task force. We were looking at when people were incarcerated and how that time of incarceration could be used better used to prepare them for reentry. Alex convinced me that, no, the work has to start even before that. That is, before someone enters, to make sure that their affairs are in order. That if you can do, if you can take care of certain things pre-entry, it's going to prevent you know, the accumulation of fines and perhaps poor decisions related to family members, children's placements, those kinds of things, in a very broad way. And I invited Alex to come to the task force and present on this concept, and people just ate it up because, and I think you'll see when you hear about it, it just makes a lot of sense. So it's my pleasure to bring this before you, colleagues, and allow you to hear more about this concept.
All right, thank you. Looks like we have probably three panels for today, unless there's others. Alex, why don't you go ahead and come on up. Brian, if you'll come back up. And Julia Yoshimoto. We're just talking about whether we can move the bill today. It looks like we're pretty well there. We could potentially move it.
Yeah, this is a different one.
Oh, a different one. Okay, sorry. Okay, and did you want to make any other comments as to this bill?
No, I think that pretty well succinct. We just have the dash two, and I think there might be still some more possible amendments in the future, but I'll let you all address that.
All right, I'm going to let Alex start off, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Alex Bassos. I'm the Director of Training and Outreach at the Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland, Oregon. I'm sort of the guy in charge of all the special programs. So this bill would provide a single social worker that would do pre-entry services for both Multnomah County. We also cover Washington County and a rural county, which we believe will be Douglas County at this point. I've talked to the executive director of the public defender office there, and they're very excited about it. It also turns out that the Department of Corrections runs their local parole and probation, so we would be able to get relatively easy metrics when working with the Department of Corrections. And also, very interestingly, they have a program there in Douglas County that they're doing with their justice reinvestment money, where people are incarcerated in a drug treatment program locally for 6 months. So that's a significant period of being absent from the community where they really need their affairs prepared and put in order to be absent from the community, which is really what this program is all about, whether it's a lengthy jail stay or a Department of Corrections stay. Things can be made worse. Their life can be made worse if we aren't doing some basic things to prepare them for that absence. So let me back up just a step. We at the Metropolitan Public Defender have been engaged in this process of trying to move from a traditional sort of criminal defense where it's really focused on the success of the criminal case to a broader thinking, holistic defense where we're trying to figure out how to build the long-term success of our clients, help with the long-term success of our clients. It's a really different kind of thinking. It's a big shift in focus, and it's got a lot of different pieces. One of the things we did very early on is we wanted to map all the resources in the community and see what we needed to build from scratch internally and what was already out there. And high on our list of people to talk with were the folks at the Mercy Corps Reentry Transition Center. And they did indeed have resources for us that we could immediately start using in a partnership with them. But more importantly, they told us in no uncertain terms that we were doing it wrong. So while I appreciate the credit from Senator Dembro, this idea came almost entirely from the reentry community, which was telling us that there were some relatively simple things that we could be doing prior to incarceration that if we didn't do, they build up and get worse and worse and worse until they're impossibly large barriers on the back end. It takes us about 10 minutes prior to incarceration to put someone's child support in abeyance. They can't pay child support while they're incarcerated, of course. That's why there's a statute and an administrative rule that makes it, and a form, a state form, that makes it relatively easy to put child support in abeyance. If we don't do that and it builds up all the way through a term of incarceration, then there's this impossibly large debt on the back end that makes it more difficult to get employment, housing, person can be charged with a felony, collections can be after that person. Turns out there are a dozen kinds of things that are like this that we ended up working through and developing. Let me give you just a couple other examples. To me, it's pretty clear that this program pays for itself just by having us suss out and resolve small holds that are out there, detainers from municipal courts, for example, that don't put their information into OGIN. Those holds or detainers can then prevent a person from being eligible for transitional leave, so now they stay in the Department of Corrections longer, and the first thing they have to do when they get out is resolve that hold, meaning that whatever reentry planning has been done is immediately shifted. There's that wave that ends up hitting the person, as we've talked about. Instead of being a smooth transition, they are enveloped in this wave. Documents, as the committee has already heard, is something very similar. If we don't do something to secure those documents, trying to replace them on the back end at reentry can be very difficult. It's a Rube Goldberg puzzle to try to get someone ID when they don't have ID. In order to get ID, you need ID. It's this really strange catch-22 that you can't even get into the federal building to get your Social Security card if you don't have ID and a Social Security card. Like, it's just this really difficult process that is a wave that hits the person, making it impossible to get that employment, housing, or basic stability. And without those things, people end up back in the system. And of course, the family piece is a huge part of this. We didn't talk about that so much with the Reentry Transition Center, but this has come up again and again as we've talked with other folks, that there is a set of issues that are particular to women in prison, particularly involving women and children, but also with men and children and the documents that need to be prepared to make sure that the children and family are safe. There are things that need to be done to create a structure for folks. If a hasty decision is made to place a child with the wrong person, that wrong decision, that hastily made decision prior to incarceration, is so difficult to undo once the person is incarcerated, creating enormous stress, enormous difficulty, and potential harm and instability for both the family and the person. There are just a ton of things down the line that are problematic. So the basic idea here is we want to realign criminal defense, public defense. So once the case is resolved, once we know that there's going to be a plea, which is the vast majority of the cases, right? More than 90% of cases plea. So we know there's going to be a resolution. Now, really, we are all involved in the same effort. And we ought to be aligned and a bridge built from public defense to the Department of Corrections, Department of Community Justice, the reentry folks, everyone else who's involved in this effort to get folks back on track. Stated another way, lower costs and lower recidivism, right? We're all interested in the same thing, whether we're thinking about it as our client who we want to get back on the path to success or less use of prison beds or less system costs. It ends up being the same thing. But traditionally, we have not thought about public defense that way. We have thought about it as a constitutional necessity, an entity that is adversarial to the effort of public safety, when in fact we are engaged in the exact same thing or trying to be. So that is the biggest thing that this one position can do. Build a bridge between these various entities that can align the entirety of the criminal justice system toward a better future.
All right, thank you. Who would like to go next?
Chair, Vice Chair, committee members, again, thank you. My name is Brian Judd, Jr. I began working with the reentry clients in 2011, as well as experienced reentry myself. Working for Bridges to Change as a house manager, then as a mentor, and eventually as program manager in Multnomah County. And we soon began to realize many of the reentry clients we worked with suffered and faced the same challenges. Evictions that could have been avoided, utility bills and collections, student loans in default, bank accounts gone bad, child support modifications that never happened, lack of temporary guardianship to enroll children in school, financial wreckage that our clients owned, but clearly never had any way to help prevent these barriers from growing during their absence. I could safely state that throughout the 5+ work of years in reentry, I've seen very few clients who did not have any financial consequences that could have been mitigated if they would have been provided with a modest amount of assistance. And I can state that many of our clients have faced reentry with multiple compounding issues that if they'd been offered the chance to address would have made the chance of their successful integration much higher. Starting out with next to nothing is hard enough. The idea was if we could somehow offer help getting people's financials in order before they go in the system, the payback would be an immense return on the investment. By nature, the earlier we tackle a problem, the easier it is to solve. It's even more factual with financial situations as time adds interest and penalties to face down the road. And as reentry services have grown, we've had more frontline service providers gain the ability to see patterns and potential solutions to our clients' unnecessary accumulation of barriers because they lack the knowledge and resources to take normal, prudent actions to settle their affairs. As many of these desired actions of these clients are restricted by incarceration from them taking steps towards, it was soon determined through collaboration that the ideal point and source of intercession was immediately prior to serving their time. And upon discerning that many of these preventive actions would require, if not power of attorney or legal representation, social service agencies' assistance, it was logical that the defense attorney's proximity to and access to these clients would be the most effective and efficient way to administer this service delivery. So this pilot has the ability to save not just the clients, but service providers and governmental resources far beyond estimation. And for these reasons, I respectfully request full consideration and support for this bill. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, members.
Thank you. And Julia?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Julia Yoshimoto, and I'm an attorney and project director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. The Oregon Justice Resource Center is a nonprofit public interest law firm located in Portland, Oregon, that works to address unmet legal needs of justice-involved individuals and works on criminal justice reform in Oregon. As a project director, I have two projects, the Reentry Law Project and the Women in Prison Project. And in both projects, I provide civil or non-criminal legal assistance to both incarcerated individuals and formerly incarcerated individuals to help reduce barriers to reentry, help reduce some of the collateral consequences, and help people navigate through the systems. So through both of these projects, I've seen the wider array of civil matters that folks are trying to tackle and overcome when they're coming out of prison or jail. With the women that I work with at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, again, I see a wide array of civil matters that they're trying to deal with from prison to help their reentry planning. And there is just such a great challenge of doing anything from prison. The communication, the flow of information is really difficult. But they know that when they get out, they're going to be facing an overwhelming number of issues. And so they're trying to do what they can to plan for it and deal with it from prison. And so of all of these civil matters, I would say that the majority of them are related to finances or debt issues. A lot of the women are just trying to figure out how much they owe, who they owe it to, what are the consequences of not paying which amounts, because they know they're likely going to be going into a low-paying job with a lot of other expenses that they have to deal with. So they're trying to figure out how are these debts going to be collected. I've worked with women who see higher education as critical to their reentry planning because of the stability of being in the educational environment. It's working toward more opportunity for themselves and their children. But for a few of the women that I worked with, they were in higher education before incarceration, have defaulted on their loans. And then by the time I'm meeting with them, we're talking about not how they're going to apply for financial aid, but how they plan for the fact that they can't take out student loans right away and will have to sort of wait that time to rehabilitate before they can apply for school. I've worked with a couple of women who are concerned that significant others have access to their debit cards, state ID, social security numbers, birth certificates, and are potentially accessing their checking accounts or opening up credit cards or loans in their name. So a majority of the civil issues that I see are around those financial needs that potentially could be prevented prior to going into prison. And then I would say the other bulk of issues are all related around the family connections. And so when individuals are sort of in those times of like the criminal activity or going through the criminal process, there's just so much chaos and crisis that sometimes for the women, it's difficult for them to understand what that their status is with their kids. So when they're incarcerated, what are the guidelines around their communication with their children? When they're planning for reentry, how do they step back into their children's lives? What does the guardianship mean? What does the child custody judgment mean? And so at the OJRC, we've just really seen that there's such a great need for civil legal assistance for justice-involved individuals. And so we're in support of this pre-entry pilot program. And while we recognize that it's not legal services, we think that this is a really great first step into preventing some of these matters that are going to just sort of compound while people are incarcerated. And we think it's a good recognition that most of the individuals that are going into jail or prison are going to be coming back out into our community, and we can make sort of a small investment up front to help prevent and to increase the chances of stability when folks are trying to transition out. And we think that that just furthers improving public safety and the welfare of our communities. So the OJRC urges your support on Senate Bill 692. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. So I'm going to ask Nova and Kendra to please come back up, and Lane, if you'll join them. Hi. So ladies, you'll have to put your name back on the record for this testimony. Thanks.
Can we go first? I can go first this time. My name's Kendra Wright, formerly incarcerated, been out and released for 18 months. I am fully in support of this pilot program.
I think that a pre-entry program would have helped in a lot of the barriers that I've faced since entering back into society. I could have addressed my fines and fees during the time that they were issued and started making payments while incarcerated, which would have given me a great head start to the financial burden that I now face. One of the biggest concerns that could have been addressed is my daughter. I had an open DHS case upon entry into prison. It was a total of 18 months before I actually got to see my daughter. At the time, she was 6 years old, and to a six-year-old, she didn't understand why she couldn't see mom or why she wasn't allowed to speak to mom. And it was due to the fact that I was fighting my termination case and appealing it. So there were some legal stipulations that my DHS worker had implemented. If I would have had an advocate or somebody there to represent my daughter and I, that could have all been avoided. So my daughter crying in her closet because she missed her mom could have never happened, or maybe to that extent. It wasn't until an intervention with joining the Family Preservation Project that that actually happened. That program, which many women don't have access to, allowed me to address my pre-entry issues. They acted as an advocate for my daughter and I, so I was then allowed contact and visitation. They addressed the issues that have been presented, like financial burdens and housing and things like that. But again, most inmates are not allowed access to that. So the last 6 months of your incarceration, you finally start to get into classes and different programs that the prison offers to address those issues. But even that is barely touching the surface. And there's a lot of stress and anxiety that goes along with that. So a pre-entry would definitely help in a lot of situations. Thank you.
Thank you. Nova?
My name's Nova Sweet, members of the committee, chair, co-chair. Pre-entry is brilliant. I totally agree. I'd like to advocate for Benton County or to beat the social worker. That group. Anyways, so one of the big things that happened for me, two things. I had an attorney, public defender, who was great. She's been around a really long time, and so she had me sign a power of attorney once I was pleading, or however that worked. And so my mom immediately had guardianship. She like was in front of the, she knew what to do. So thank God for that, because I would have had to do other hurdles. So that was something that was great, that pre-entry could help with a lot of parents, moms, dads, whoever. The other thing is taxes. I went to prison when I hadn't filed taxes for that year, and then I was in prison for the next year, and I had had employment. So my state and federal taxes, I didn't pay. So to Oregon and the feds, it looked like I was being delinquent. And so I started getting penalties. My mom did try and take care of this for me in the community, and it wouldn't work. They wouldn't, for whatever reason, they wouldn't communicate with her. So fast forward, I'm out now. I immediately had to pay, go on a payment plan for my state taxes, which was very difficult, by the way. But I was able to pay off the $900 in late fees and yada, yada, yada. Just now, I filed got my federal taxes done, and that $3,600 was able to pay for all that extra late fees and whatnot. So now I'm in the stage of where I get to ask for them to give me back my late fees because I had a pre-existing condition that didn't allow me to file my taxes on time. So all that kind of financial stuff could have been taken care of, I believe, had somebody been able to communicate with the IRS that I was actually not able to pay taxes, not that I wasn't trying to. The other thing is, so there are institutional counselors, there is FPP, there are treatment counselors all inside the Department of Corrections that are trying to help people with all these kinds of things, but they're super burdened. I mean, they have a ton of stuff to do, so why not have an additional support group before you even go to prison to help those people. I mean, it just it makes sense because it lessens the burden along the way for all these professionals. And I think a great pre-entry leads to a great re-entry. And rather than a bridge, I'd like to think about like a roundabout, you know? Let's have the roundabout get smaller because as we support these inmates or adults in custody, reestablish their lives at the front end or the back end, they eventually get off that roundabout and the roundabout shrinks. And for me, it makes sense. So I'm in full support of this bill passing. Thank you.
Thank you. Lane.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, Chair, and members of the committee. And thank you, Senator Dembro, for introducing this bill. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders, or in today's relevance, Alex's boss. This is, I'm in support of this really because this so perfectly aligns with the mission of what Alex and I have been trying to do to realign Metropolitan Public Defenders and the mission of public defense. We need to stop thinking of public defense as responsive or reflective of once a charge is filed because we have such an opportunity to work with clients for the time period that we do. And as Alex mentioned, he said, you know, 90%, 85, 90% of cases are pled out. And that's true and it's been true for decades. But I can't tell you at arraignment which one is going to plead out. And so we need to stop wasting that time and utilize that time to plan for people's success. So this aligns for us because, first of all, it's innovative. I don't think anybody else in the country is doing this, and it is, and you know, this is the Oregon way. I'm very proud of the fact that I just received by email a letter, Senator, you'll be receiving from Jeff Howes, who is Chief Deputy of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, in support of this program because he sees that this is an innovation that is we need to do. We need to move down to utilize this to build for people's success. It's also aligned with the concept of being solution-based, that we're getting away from just how do we respond to, how many motions to suppress do we win, or how many trials do we have. It's really trying to focus on, especially for that 85-90% of the people that are planning their resolution through a plea, to say, what are your actual needs? What are ways that you can be successful? Now, we're going to do this for people going straight to probation, but we shouldn't be ignoring the people that are going into institutions and have very real needs that we can, with relatively simple work ahead of time, forestall and prevent those barriers from being produced. And finally, it is measurable. And that's something that's near and dear to my heart in my world of policy meetings and Multnomah County Justice Reinvestment and looking at whether we're being successful or not. There's some very simple matrix we're going to be able to see, and we're going to be able to see them relatively quickly because aside from the fact that the women next to me are really the customers of who we hope to be serving, the state customers, the Department of Corrections, and they're going to need to come back to you in 2 or 3 or 4 years and say, does this help them? Is this making their life easier because they're getting people coming in at Coffee Creek who already have detainers lifted or addressed? They have fines and fees that are not just hanging out there. They've gotten documents in order so that when they do start the reentry planning, they know that they can launch this person into housing, into success that way. So though we're going to be able to measure it. The next customer is going to be our Department of Community Corrections and Parole and Probation around the state. Are people coming out of institutions better able to reenter because these barriers don't have to be addressed first? They can get into housing. They can get employment. So I think that I'm confident that that we'll be able to measure what the success is. And also, perhaps sadly, because this is a competitive advantage as a nonprofit I have, it's going to be relatively cheap compared to other things. And I think the ROI is likely to be very high on this because when it comes back from legislative fiscal, I anticipate it's going to be less than $100,000 for this pilot project on an annual basis. And to put that into perspective, my friends at DOC can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when you're talking about $100 a day, $95 to $100 a day, and compared that just on the transitional leave, I think if we affect maybe 15 to 20 more people into transitional leave in a year, you're going to pay for the program. And that doesn't even count the cost of how fast we can reintegrate people and work people with reentry and back into their community. Because the success on this is not just, from my opinion, from my office's opinion, it's not just did they not reoffend? It's did they are they parenting again? Are they working again? Are they in housing? Those are the matrices that we should be ultimately measuring, because that's the matrices that the offenders actually care about. You know, I'm not trying to be glib about it, but you know, I'm starting to come to the opinion that recidivism is not really a goal. Non-recidivism is not really a goal of my clients, because that will be a response to the situation that they face at the time. Their goal is really to be a parent, be employed, be living somewhere. And that should be what we're working for. So I really appreciate your taking up this, and I urge you to pass it.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Our last panel that's scheduled is Jeremiah, Eric, and Mary. Why don't you three come up? While they're coming up, was there anyone else who did not get signed up who wanted to give testimony on 692?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I will say that a number of people have submitted written testimony, including Mr. House, as was just mentioned.
Right. Who would like to start?
I'll go ahead.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senator Dembro. My name is Mary Sell, and I'm here with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am one of the lobbyists. I'm lobbying with Gail Meyer. I am in a kind of a unique position because I also have had the pleasure to be employed by Lane and Alex, or Alex's boss, as he's put himself on the record. And so I guess the first thing that I want to say is I personally have the utmost confidence that Metropolitan Public Defender is going to be a wonderful shepherd of this pre-entry program. And I think that when you're looking at the situation, it couldn't be in better hands. They obviously have the community support, they have the leadership, and they really do have the people on the ground who care so much about our clients. And I think that that is important to highlight. My role with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, from our perspective, essentially represent the people who are doing the representation of our clients, and we're absolutely in support of moving this forward. Our membership is made up of people at Metropolitan Public Defender, court-appointed lawyers, other people who are going to be able to impact this system, and I think putting resources up front to make sure that people are able to re-enter down the line without all of these significant barriers is going to be amazing. I personally have practiced in Douglas County. Hearing Douglas County being singled out as a kind of a pilot place, as a pilot program recipient, it's amazing. I can picture that community. I can picture the clients that I represented every single day. And I know that it's going to benefit them. And I know that once this expands and has a broader reach, because I have every confidence that it's going to be successful, it's just going to have such an amazing impact on our clients. It's going to have an amazing impact on essentially the practitioners for OCDLA. And so we're in full support. And I think that's really probably all that I want to say. And so thank you, and we urge passage. And thank you to all of the people who have put so much time into attacking this problem. This is great.
All right, thank you. Who's next? Eric, looks like you volunteered.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name is Eric Dietrich. I'm Deputy General Counsel for the Office of Public Defense Services, and it is good to be back here in the Judiciary Committee. The Office of Public Defense Services is the nonpartisan agency that administers the state's public defense system. We're overseen by a commission, the Public Defense Services Commission, which has not yet reviewed this bill, and that's why I wrote down neutral now. The commission meets Thursday. I will be highlighting this for them, and I can report back to the chair thereafter. Having said that, the ideas in this bill are things that the commission has always endorsed in improving and acknowledging the role that public defenders can have in improving public safety, developing metrics so that we can show our effectiveness in improving public safety. These are things the commission has advocated for some time. I just want to speak to another piece in the legislation, which is the integrated use of social workers in public defense offices, because I don't think that's been highlighted so much this morning. The commission has shown an interest in integrating social workers into public defense offices. The relationship between a public defense attorney and their client is a unique relationship, and it's a confidential relationship. But attorneys aren't always the best communicators. Social workers are trained at communicating. They know how to identify a person's needs, and they know how to route them to social services. And so we see that when you combine social workers with the attorney-client relationship, you can get access to information about a person's needs that you may not otherwise get that can steer them to the right path. So, for example, in the last year, the commission, in conjunction with the Interim Judiciary Committee, the Department of Justice, and the Oregon State Bar, we put on a panel of state and national experts in public defense here at the Capitol in September. One of those was Mr. Bassos, and we had the chief defender from Kentucky come, and Kentucky was dealing with an opioid epidemic, rising incarceration costs. And when they looked at ways to solve this problem, they did a pilot program by using social workers in public defense offices to develop alternative sentencing strategies. And it was so effective, they actually expanded it statewide, and they have found that using social workers with public defense providers can improve outcomes and save money. And another use of social workers here in Oregon is in the parent-child representation program that PDSC has developed with the legislature that focuses on improving outcomes in child welfare, juvenile dependency cases. There's a couple of pillars to that program, which are having the attorneys have reasonable caseloads and more quality assurance mechanisms. But another pillar to that program is the use of social workers with the attorneys in representing parents and children. That has also shown to be an effective strategy, and the attorneys really report that it's beneficial in their representation. So I want to thank this committee for considering this legislation and particularly continuing the conversation about the use of social workers with public defense providers and how that can be effective going forward.
Jeremiah.
Well, good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director of Community Corrections with the Department of Corrections. And so I'm here to testify in regards to Senate Bill 692 this morning. This pilot, certainly as you've heard this morning and described in my conversations with Metropolitan Public Defenders and Senator Dembro's office, revolves around focusing on addressing those financial, legal, and custodial obligations, as well as other issues prior to entry into the Department of Corrections. When a person arrives at intake, the Department of Corrections begins working immediately with these individuals for their eventual return to the community. 97% of all of our inmates will return to the community, and most, as you heard from much of the testimony this morning, is within 2 to 3 years. During this time, these significant issues, it's extremely important that we're able to resolve financial and legal burdens as they do grow over time and prevents individuals from participating in our early release programs and adds stress to the individual as they attempt to navigate these complex and difficult systems from inside institution walls. This pilot won't eliminate the need for DOC to continue to provide assistance and support to these issues. But it does alleviate some of the most common factors and issues that individuals face during their incarceration. As Eric addressed, a social worker or a similar type professional will be more equipped and able to build trust with a defendant to work on their legal and financial responsibilities, as opposed to correctional staff, whom many entering our DOC institutions are not inclined to trust. And so with this, DOC is grateful to see efforts such as this bill, which will improve the likelihood that an individual can succeed upon reentry back to the community. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for anyone? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
That concludes our public testimony on Senate Bill 692, so we'll close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, can I just say I just got a message from AOC, Patrick, saying he wanted to have it put on the record. They're very supportive of both of these bills.
All right. It's on the record. Great. Thank you very much. So with that, we have two bills for work session. I'm going to go ahead and carry over Senate Bill 493. I understand we got a minimum financial impact, but I need to speak with the President's office regarding the subsequent referral. So we're going to carry over Senate Bill 493 till tomorrow. I've looked at the schedule. It should be pretty quick to do. So that will be part of the record so it can be carried over without
being subsequently posted. And now we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 751. And Whitney, if you'll give us an overview.
Yes, thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. We previously heard Senate Bill 751 on March 2nd. If you recall, Senate Bill 751 was brought to us by Senator Gelser, and it prohibits a marriage application, license, or record from requiring the address of a person, religious organization, or congregation authorized to solemnize marriages. Since the March 2nd public hearing, we did get the Dash 1 amendment, which is up on OLIS. The Dash 1 amendment removes the prohibition on the forms requiring the address of the person authorized to solemnize marriages. So what it is that the forms can still have require the address for the person performing the marriage, but puts the prohibition for requiring the address of the congregation or religious organization that is a part of that. There is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right, thank you. Senator Thatcher?
Oh, just a question. There is too many double negatives going on there. I'm just trying to make sure. Removes the okay, so the forms are still going to be the same, but it's not going to be a requirement that the address for the organization or congregation be filled out, in other words. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, Vice Chair Thatcher. I think it prohibits them from requiring the address. I don't know how the state registrar would change their forms, if they would still keep it on there and just tell the person it's voluntary or not, but they wouldn't be allowed to require the congregation's address. They could require the person's address. So I think we heard some testimony on March 2nd of them needing at least a person's address if they need to communicate with that person or follow up. And so the actual person that's performing the marriage, they can require that address. But I believe we heard from one of the witnesses about how the congregation that had I'm not sure of the words for how that works, but had made her a pastor, no longer existed, and that was giving her some difficulty in performing these marriages. So the congregation and the religious organization that is involved with that, those addresses would no longer allowed to be required.
Okay. And also I was wondering, too, based on some questioning that was done during the last testimony, it sounds like the forms have to have certain things on them, but it's up to, well, it sounded like if somebody wrote non-applicable in a box that that could suffice currently. Maybe I misunderstood.
Yes, Chair Prezonsky, Vice Chair Thatcher, I do recall some testimony about that. I didn't follow up with it too much beyond I did confirm with legislative counsel that there's currently no law requiring that those addresses be provided, but that they have been on the forms. And I think we heard some other testimony from some of the witnesses that they were having issues when they didn't have those addresses. I think the witness I referenced earlier said she had to go through one of those internet religious organizations to get the ability to put an address on the form, even though that wasn't her actual denomination. And so this is just specifying or making it clear to the state registrar that's developing these forms that except for the actual person, when it comes to the congregation or religious organization, they cannot require the address.
Okay. Why don't we do this for protocol? Why don't we go ahead and make the motion and we'll continue the discussion?
I'm sorry,
no, that's
Chair.
Quite all right.
All right. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 6, 2017.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves to for the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated March 6, 2017. Continuing the discussion, what I wanted to just go ahead and put on the record, real quickly, put the Dash 1s up, and it's taking the words person or off of line 19. So reading after on line 19 basically said subsection, I think it's 2 of this section, may not require an address for any religious organization or congressional authorized by blah, blah, blah. So it's taking out the requirement of not requiring something for a person. So my reading of that, which is a double negative, not a triple negative, is that they can require a person's address, but they can't require the religious organization.
I think this is problematic. This is too many rules on top of too many rules, requiring that you cannot require, et cetera. The county clerk who was here testified, and I recall, as Whitney mentioned a moment ago, that I asked if you put a N/A for not applicable in that address box, is the form filled out appropriately? And he answered affirmative. Yes, that's all we need is an NA in there and we're good to go. So I think for us to, as a legislative body, to delve into telling people what their form has to look like, where the logo has to be, what they can and can't ask for, it's really a overkill on our part. So I can't support legislation like this because we're just digging a hole that somebody may have to backfill in the future when information isn't appropriate and they really need this information to get on with life. I think the county clerk has the ability, the law does not say an individual must provide. It says whoever develops the form can't require the form. And if they require it or don't require it is not anything that I think we need to jump into. So those are just my thoughts. I think we've just overstepped the boundary of reasonable legislation here.
All right. Senator Dimbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I sympathize with the how many double negatives is enough. But apparently this was a problem. Right, and so there, you know, if we could count on all the county clerks to address this the right way, maybe we wouldn't have a problem. But it seems that there is a problem, and this may be a way of avoiding future difficulties for people, you know, such as we heard about. If so, then that's a good thing. I agree with you. It would be great if this would just go away as a problem, but absent our action, I'm not sure it will.
I will just follow up. I'm going to support the motion because I think for simplicity, it's going to give some uniformity across the board because I can see where one clerk may interpret one thing. Others, I think, just as important, unless you change the form to say you can put in NA where it doesn't apply, you're going to have people who are filling out the forms to give to the clerk not doing it right. And so I think this is a way that it basically will designate that it's the person who's officiating will be the one's address they're looking for as compared to an address of an organization that may or may not still exist. Any other comments?
Yeah. What was that? What was the dash one again? What was that?
The dash one removes the word person or. So on line 19, it takes out that portion. And yes, it could be constructed differently, so it wouldn't read the way it does, where it says this section may not require an address for religious organizations or congregational authorized, and it goes on from there. So it's removing the requirement, and in this case, the solicitation of an address for a religious or organization or the congregation. Any other questions? Senator Manning, does that help you focus on how that changes it?
Yeah, I see. And I think for uniformity, Mr. Chair, is there any kind of way that I could talk to the proponent of this before we move this forward? Can we just...
We can do that. All right. I'm going to go ahead and carry over. Let's see. We got a motion before us, so I'm going to ask if you would be so kind to
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves to withdraw her motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and the purpose for that is to allow members to check in with other individuals before we actually have a vote. With that, if there's no objection to the motion to move, I don't know if we actually need to do it. I'm not seeing anyone with that. That's ordered. And what we are going to do now is carry over Senate Bill 751. How about 751? And we're carrying it over to tomorrow as well. And so tomorrow, the two bills that we have currently scheduled for today for work session, and I'm just want to get to my own page here. Senate Bill 493 and Senate Bill 751 are carried over for work sessions tomorrow, which will be Wednesday, March 15th. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session that we had on 751. We've taken care of the clarification, and I think that takes care of our work. So we'll adjourn for today and be back here tomorrow at 8. Thank you. Thank you.